Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2022, October 21. IB John Pasmino. Our lesson today is the lunar eclipse of 2022, November 8th. We had several eclipse sessions for both solar and lunar eclipses. They happen to occur, at least in these years, rather frequently visible in the New York vicinity. So this is one. We'll have another one next year, and we'll actually have one for the partial solar eclipse also next year. You better have both files, the besides the narration audio you're listening to, go get the video file, which has the slideshow. Seeing one or hearing one without the other will get nonsense. So stop at www.nyskies.org. Among the jump words at the top of the home page is audio video files. Kick it. You can skip the text for the time being, but do note that it reminds you about the New York Skies email group. So you have companionship in astronomy by conversing with the members of that group. After the text are links to this and about a year and a half back issues of the seminar. The one you're looking for is near the bottom, Lunar Eclipse of 2022, November 8th. And you see the two files, PPT for the video and the MP3 for the audio. So if your buddy has the slides without the narration, you know where to send them. Okay, I left you a quiz with the last lesson on observing Mars. I asked you to look at a particular picture in that lesson with the model globes of the Earth and the other terrestrial-like planets, and using some facts and figures about the size and the proportion of water and land on the Earth, what curious feature of Mars did you arrive at? Well, most of you got this right. Well, some of you used approximate methods, and others got everything right down to the last square kilometer. So this slide one, because now you have the video file right, shows in brief what's going on. It gives there the surface area of Mars, which you can get by the pi r squared formula, knowing the radius of Mars. You got the radius and area of the Earth, and also from any geography book that only about 29% of the Earth is land and all the rest is open water surface. If you do that comparison, you get the astounding realization that the total surface of Mars, which by the way is all land, there is no open water, is quite equal to the land area of Earth. And I have a little diagram on the bottom. The left large square showed the three quarters of Earth being water and the hatched area being land. And then Mars, whose total area is about a quarter of the Earth and all of it is land, and you see graphically the equality. And those who did it approximately simply said, well, half the diameter is a quarter of the surface area, and we know that the Earth is a quarter land and water, so you made the equality that way. Others went through the geography book or whatever and got the exact numbers, but in either case, it came out pretty damn close. If you go to slide 2, this answers questions. It was not a quiz, but some of you were, hey, all freaked out that during the opposition of Mars, now in 2022, there is also on the same date a conjunction, a close miss, or occultation of Mars by the Moon. And hey, that's really cool. When did it happen before? How often does it happen? Well, I personally remember the one when the opposition was in the spring, and I remember it as being in April, where the full moon was right next to the Mars within a day or two of opposition. But I was curious about other instances, and here is where the astrologer comes in. So I fired up the astrology program and pretended that my client had a propitious moment only if Mars is in opposition and the full moon is in conjunction with it. Okay, so I threw that at the astrology program for the period 2000 to 2040. In other words, going for the 21st century and a little bit beyond the, say, the remaining lifespan for most of us. Of course, if you're a submillennial, you go to the end of the century. Medical and sanitation and longevity would improve. And the program spit out these dates with a one-day leeway of when the opposition Mars also is in conjunction with the Moon. And you see there, wow, about 8 of them going out to the year. Well, 2039 is the last one. I guess the one after that goes beyond. Well, that's the opposition, so the next opposition would be in 2041, outside the range. And this gives me a, and of course I then verified this with a standard astronomy planetarium program, and all of these do in fact comply. So if you got one of those horoscope astrology programs, exercise it, please. We'll have one example of a astrology program use for the lunar eclipse that's coming down the pike. Okay, we have the title slide for our lesson in slide 3. And it summarizes the AV files page on the web in reverse order. Since you're looking at the video file, it reminds you to go get the audio if you didn't have it. At the bottom are supplemental readings. One, the first one there, ECL-FACT, Eclipse Facts, which is all the boilerplate that I used to put in the announcements or preparations for eclipses. And I finally asked a couple of times back in the early 2000s. I was just repeating myself. So I took all the boilerplate out, added some other little goodies, and it's in the web as a distinct article so that I can concentrate when I post in the New York Skies e-group about the eclipse, just the data for the eclipse, and they say, okay, for the background and technicalia, go to the ECL-FACT article. The next one, Yes, Yes, No, .htm, is the result of my observations of the lunar eclipse in May of this year. And it was actually the experience that pretty much everyone else had, too. And to make a long story short, I set up to view the eclipse, and the beginning and even the initial partial phases were well observed. And then the next time I went out to look for it, totally clouded out. This can happen for any eclipse. Now, for solar eclipses, this is especially important because solar eclipses often spawn trips and tours and expeditions to the eclipse path. You know, the lunar eclipse, you can see over half or more of the Earth, that is, wherever the moon is in the sky, whereas a solar eclipse can be seen only where the moon's tiny shadow cuts across the surface. So you take a ship or a plane, a land tour, and all the eclipse groups advertise that they had the best weathermen, the best climatologists, the best forecasters, and yes, our trip will give you 99.9% clear weather for the eclipse. But you must always, always know that it cannot be guaranteed, and the tour operator cannot possibly be held liable if, given his due diligence and competence, the weather turns against us. In fact, one eclipse which I lost was the one in 1991. I went to Hawaii. 80% chance of seeing the eclipse, and I was there for 5 days. The eclipse was in the morning. So 4 of those mornings, brilliant, bright, blue sky, brilliant sun, excellent eclipse weather. And one of those days, the morning was cloudy until after last contact, and then it cleared up. So that can happen. So that's yes, yes, no. This eclipse is a bit special because, number one, we will be in Standard Time, November 6th. We flip the clocks back 1 hour to get off of Daylight Savings Time and return to Standard Time, appropriate to your zone or your longitude. That, of course, is in the United States. I think Canada follows the same rule. And if you are doing this lesson overseas, by all means, check with your time service or almanac or some such and learn when you go back. But the returns are all within the October-November period, and it turns out in the U.S. we go back on the 6th, and the eclipse is on the 8th. And slide 4 just reminds you of this using a poster of any number that you may see in the corner of the weather page in your newspaper or a picture-in-picture during the evening news broadcast on the telly. In 5, another promo, November 8th in the United States, is the general election day, where for in-person voting, you go to your balloting station, cast your vote for the various races. There are no presidential candidates, but you have congressionals and senators for Congress and a whole raft of state and local races. So the eclipse occurs in the, depending on your time zone, in the late night of the 7th going into the 8th, that's like on the west coast of the U.S., through the pre-dawn and sunrise for us on the east coast, and then you put your hat on and go to vote. So during the daylight of the 8th, the eclipse is already gone, but I don't want you to get so hyped up for the eclipse that you forget about your civic duty to vote. Remember, votes, at least in the United States, really do count. We don't have these Iranian or Venezuelan type elections. So please vote, vote, vote. In 6, we see the mechanism of a lunar eclipse. Now this is a pretty schlocky picture, and actually every picture which fits into a page in print or on a viewing screen would be completely out of scale for sizes of the three bodies and distances, because here you have the sun about 2 of his own diameters, 2 Earth diameters away from the Earth. We'll be orbiting in the outer corona of the real sun. And we have the moon, which looks like a little pebble compared to the Earth. But they all will have these gross distortions of distances, of spacings, and of size in an effort to keep the objects within the same viewing area. What is the actual scale? Okay, if on your viewing device the Earth is 2 cents diameter, 20 mils, the moon would be about 7 millimeter diameter and 60 centimeters away. So already you see that if we use just the Earth and the Moon, they would not conveniently fit in the width of most, say, computer, even a larger half-meter screen for a desktop computer. And forget about it if you're looking at a thumbnail-sized screen on your telephone. Now what about the sun? Well, with that 20 millimeter diameter Earth, the sun would be a sphere, 2 meter diameter, and if you live in a inner city apartment, there won't be much room for you, and it would have to be placed 200 meters away from the Earth. Now, remember, an ordinary American football field is 100 meters long. That includes the end zones. So you're talking about a distance from the Earth to the Sun on this scale of 2 football fields away. So just keep that in mind, because every textbook on astronomy, every web on astronomy, every news article on astronomy will have a picture somewhat like this. Some fancier, some plainer, some with more labels, but it will always have this grotesque distortion of the sizes and spacings between the Earth, Sun, and Moon. So if you have newcomers into astronomy, or if you're giving a talk to a school group where the teacher has really no choice but to show this to their kids, you might try to model that out. You may even bring a 2-centimeter arts and crafts ball and a 7-millimeter, let's say, arts and crafts for the moon, and a folding meter stick. They do sell them, like the ones the carpenters use. Yeah, so get one of them, and you can lay out in the hallway what the actual spacings would be, and then you can say, gauge by, say, the height of the wardrobe or the top of the blackboard, something that's 2 meters, and you're 200 meters away, you look out the window, and you point to a certain house or building roughly that far away. So you might try that, but that's the mechanism. As the moon goes around the Earth, it will be intercepted by the shadow of the Earth, and the moon will move through that shadow, and that constitutes the eclipse. In this scene, the orbit of the Earth around the Sun is not specifically shown, neither is the moon's orbit around the Earth. Actually, if you showed it in, it'd be scraping the Sun and be scorched by the prominences. No? Okay, we had enough of that. How long did we really know what causes eclipses? In this session, eclipses of the moon. We actually have to go back at least to the Babylonian era to see that humans understood the cause of solar and lunar eclipses. It's pretty crude, especially for the solar eclipses, because when they figured out a solar eclipse should occur, it didn't, not knowing that it occurred in another part of the world beyond their trading and exploration radius. This comes from a medieval astronomy book. The Earth is in the center, which is how the universe was built back then. The inner circle is the orbit of the moon, and the outer one is the orbit of the sun. It has a flex on it, which I think are tiny flames to show the fiery nature of the sun. So the sun shines on the Earth, which is opaque, and you have this cone shadow. They knew that, extending beyond the Earth, and the moon would dip into it. This picture I like particularly because if you look at the orbit of the moon, this actually split. One side is on the outer part of the orbit and the lower left is on the inner edge. And that is trying to show that the moon's orbit compared to the sun is tilted. I'm not sure which is which, but I'm guessing, say, that the outer part on the upper right represents the orbit tilted toward you, and the lower left side is tilted a bit away, and the axis of that tilt, the line of nodes, NFO D delta E ESA, lines up with the sun. And text, which happened to be in Latin, which is no sweat for a guinea like me, tells you what happens if the moon was not at the node. See, so the Babylonians understood this. The Egyptians did not. They did not have a cosmography or a cosmogony as the other cultures did, although they did make careful records of eclipses, and they have been very, very valuable today. The earlier astronomers, they didn't have books, even in scrolls, they typically only had text or crude charts and tables. When printing came into use around 1400, then they could make pictures. Take a wooden block and they carve the picture onto it, and then they ink it over and they put that into the frame or the case, as it's called, the block, and then the lettering strips packed around it to make the page. So the illustrations of eclipses don't come until the advent of printing, or at very early, the advent of multiple copies of a whole page. That's like a large wooden slab where they carved out the text that goes on that page and then printed that. A quick side story. There was two wonders of the world. One was the Colossus at Rhodes, which was a statue supposedly 200 meters tall of a heroic figure, a soldier of some sort, whose feet were on either side of the entrance to the harbor, and the ships entering and leaving passed between his feet. And of course the sailors, being nasty little boys, would shoot arrows up at the statue, but it being made of stone, they just bounced off. There's another wonder of the world, the lighthouse, or Pharos, P-Papa H-A-R-O-S, at Alexandria. Now both of these, that was around 200 meters tall also, and it was a fire on top which was perpetually maintained. A fellow went up there, he stayed there for roughly a month. He hauled up buckets of food and lowered down buckets of toilet matter. And he stayed there for a month, and when his duty was over, he climbed down the stairs, the next guy went up. So, but both of those were thrown down at different times by earthquake. The earthquake occurred in time long before printing, so we don't know what the statue at Rhodes actually looked like, and most modern depictions simply copy a soldier of that era as the statue. The Pharos at Alexandria came down in the Middle Ages by earthquake, but already there were diagrams and pictures of it. Egypt is using those pictures to design a replacement to be built as near as practical at the site of the original lighthouse. Now they can't really do this because, believe it or not, the Mediterranean rose a couple of meters, so you can't put a lighthouse out in the ocean. So they're going to put it on land in a setting that resembled the original lighthouse. And of course the lamp atop would be fed by gas, piped up there. And a fella might be dropped on top by helicopter or something, maybe an elevator inside the new building. But that's an interesting application, how printed illustrations were of use. So that's how the early astronomers explained eclipses. The modern method, or actually a modern representation, is in slide 8. So we have little squares that show the orbit of the moon, and it's tilted relative to the plane of the Earth's orbit. Now the sun is in the middle. Now we rebuilt the universe with Copernicus. And notice that there's a tilt. It's about 5.5 degrees. So it's a shallow, it's exaggerated here. If you look in the upper left and lower, upper right and lower left, the new moon and full moon shadow miss the Earth, so you do not get the solar eclipse, and the moon misses the Earth's shadow, and you do not get the lunar eclipse. And that's the usual case during the course of the year. There's a dozen full moons, or 13, you can squeeze the extra one in there, 13 full moons, or 13 new moons, and only a couple of them would generate eclipses. In the upper left and lower right, we have that the axis of that tilt lines up with the sun, and your new moons produce solar eclipses, and your full moons go into lunar eclipse. And so what happens is, in the course of a year, we would get eclipses in one part of the year for a month or so, and then no more eclipses until about 5.5 months later. And that's because the orbit itself is not rigid, as shown in this diagram, but it does swage a bit, so that the next time you hit the nodes would move the bit. So it's 5.5 months rather than 6, and you get more eclipses. They peter out, and you wait another 5.5 months for the next cycle. So each year will typically have 2 eclipse seasons with a mix of lunar and solar eclipses. Or if one of them occurs at the very beginning of the year, the second one will be near the middle of the year, and you may get the third one at the end of the year. And if that happens, then you get more number of eclipses than for years with just 2 seasons. So that's why you would get eclipses only sometimes, but not every new moon or full moon. Quite different from, say, on Jupiter and the 4 big moons, the Galilean moons with the Marius names, they will always produce eclipses at their new moon phase, and they will always go into the shadow of Jupiter at their full moon phase. And with 4 moons, and with short periods from a few days to 2 weeks, I might suppose that people on Jupiter were just sick and fed up with eclipses. Now, if the Sun, Earth, and Moon were planets, you would never get an exact lineup. But the Moon is a globe, a 3,500 kilometers down, the Earth is around 12,800 K, and you got the Sun, which is around 1,400,000 K diameter. So even if you don't get an exact lineup, you can get an overlap. So the number of eclipses is key to the relative angular sizes of the Sun, the Moon, and Earth's shadow. So in slide 9, we show the concept of eclipse limits, that is the leeway off of exact lineup with the nodes where the moon's orbit crosses the Earth's orbit plane, or the ecliptic as we see it in the sky. In this case, it's an ascending node where the moon is coming from the south side of the ecliptic to the north. And we have there the situations, if they're going across, the farthest away from the node, the moon misses the umbra, which is too small in this picture, misses the umbra, and we get no eclipse. But as the alignment becomes more precise, you can get where the moon will dip into the shadow as a partial eclipse, and when you get a more exact lineup, you get total, and then it's symmetrically across on the right-hand side of the node. Bear in mind that the stages there are actually separate instances of full moon. A common misinterpretation is it's a single full moon sliding across the line of nodes, and somehow the umbra is chasing along with it. The umbra is stationary in the sky. Well, it moves at the rate that the sun moves through the zodiac, because the shadows are opposite their light source. So it will move 1 degree in the zodiac in one day, the same as the sun does. So during an eclipse, it's substantially stationary against the stars. The eclipse will last about 5 hours, maybe at most. The moon slides through at 13 degrees per day, or substantially her own diameter, half a degree, every hour. So just keep that in mind. But that just illustrates that the alignment doesn't have to be exact. The disk of the moon and of the Earth's shadow at the distance of the moon, the shadow tapers as it goes out. So the size that you see in diagrams, like on the next one's coming up, it's the diameter of that cone at the distance of the moon. If the moon were some other distance away from us, that would be bigger or smaller. Okay, in slide 10, we're back to the astrologer. A horoscope cut for November 8th, 2022, about 6 o'clock in the morning, standard time. And we have the horizon, which is the horizontal bisector, east on the left, then west on the right, and we're in the middle. The stuff above the horizon, the semicircle above that, is the ecliptic in the sky, arcing out of the eastern side to the top of the picture in the south, and then down to the west. Underneath, the lower part is hidden. That's out of sky. And you see the planet symbols around there. The sun is in the east, under the horizon. It didn't rise yet. It's actually getting close to dawn. And in the western sky, getting low in the sky, we see the moon and a little horseshoe thing, which I abbreviated ANDA, ascending node. The scale in the middle is homed on the sun, so at 180 degrees is the moon. So we've got a full moon. That's one condition for a lunar eclipse. The other is you got to be close to a node. And the little horseshoe thing, ascending node, is right next to the moon, and we will have a lunar eclipse. And down at the bottom, in the lower left, we have the disindata reminding you of that lunar eclipse and the number of days to go before you get it. Obviously, it's today, with 0 days. So this picture is another way to emphasize the mechanics of an eclipse. If I did this in August, pick a date in August, cut the horoscope, the node would be too far away from the moon and there would be no advisement of an eclipse of the moon during that period. And that would be the usual situation. If you want a descending node, well, the descending node in this program is not actually marked, but it would just be 180 degrees away from the ascending one, and it would be near where the sun is. I also marked, well, actually I labeled apogee near 12 o'clock in the south. That's the farthest part on the moon's orbit. And actually in classical astronomy, angles were measured from the highest point above the Earth around the deferent and also the epicycle using those that model rather than from the perigee. And it was Kepler, when he realized that the orbits were ellipses, the mathematics of ellipses were vastly simpler by using the closest point to the sun, the perigee, and that is what we used from then on. But in the old days, apogee was the zero mark, and astrologers tend to keep it. Okay, notice that the apogee is rather far away from the moon. So the moon is not near her farthest point in her orbit and is nowhere near the perigee, again, 190 degrees away, which would be somewhere under the Earth around the 6 o'clock position. It's not marked in this program. This particular program gives you the ascending or north node and apogee only, figuring that any astrologer worth her salt knows that the opposite one is 180 degrees away or six zodiac signs away. So this is not a supermoon eclipse, nor is it a mini moon eclipse, but it does give you a very visual explanation of how eclipses occur. Look, I mentioned that when you get close to a node for a month or so, you will get a mix of lunar and solar eclipses, and then the full or new moon take place too far from the node to make eclipses until you get to the opposite node, and you get a bunch of more eclipses. So if you do that, as in slide 11, you get this drop-a-dead beautiful trend of eclipses, and you can see that most years you have two clusters of eclipses, and the lag, or that is advanced toward earlier dates, is about about 10 or so days each year. So you get this diagonal where the eclipses occur earlier. In the middle of the chart, we see a couple of years where there are three seasons at the beginning of the year, in the middle, June, July, and then in December. But the usual situation near the top and near the bottom is to have two seasons per year. Now, if you've watched eclipses of Jupiter's moons, even a large scope where you actually can get a disk on the planet and moons, when the moon goes into eclipse, it's gone. It's, the shadow of Jupiter is utterly black, with no light, and you do not see the moon until it emerges again out of the shadow, you know, on the far side. The Earth is different, and you see this in slide 12. Earth has an atmosphere, and at the top and bottom of the Earth on the left side you see that the atmosphere hugs the planet and it has a curved surface and acts like a lens. And it will refract light from the sun shining through the atmosphere inward into the shadow of the Earth. So we get actually some illumination inside the shadow, so generally the moon remains visible, much dimmer than in plain full moon phase, but pretty obvious in the sky, like a bright star, even in the middle of the umbra. That's the usual textbook situation. We'll show you later that there are all kinds of varieties, but there is light entering the shadow and lighting the moon. Furthermore, the atmosphere is a diffuser, a diffractor of light, to the sense that the shorter wavelengths are scattered, that's what makes our blue sky, and the longer wavelengths, which is toward the red, do pass through and enter into the zone covered by the umbra. Hence, the dim light that the sun gets into the umbra is also tinted by colors of the long wavelengths, nominally reddish. So when the shadow comes over the moon, instead of being a jet black, ebony black cape, it's a reddish of different hues depending on which eclipse it is. We'll look at that later. Reddish. And then when the full immersion is complete, that is totality begins, the moon is completely reddish. That's why full moons, when eclipses occur, are sometimes called blood moons, because the color alludes in mysticism to the color of blood, although the moon rarely gets to be that same shade. It's more of a fruit-colored red, cherry red or grape red. 13 is just an illustration, a borrowed picture. I don't know for sure if it's a partial eclipse or the partial phases of a total. It doesn't matter. The umbra is partially on the moon, and although it certainly is much, much darker than the exposed moon on the lower right, it is kind of reddish, or some say brown, that kind of color. So it's against the longer wavelengths of the sun diffusing into the umbra is casting light on the moon. You notice that the shadow is pretty definite. It has a little diffuse edge, but it's specifically part of a circle. And some astronomers, and especially home astronomers, they'll take snapshots of the moon during the whole eclipse. There are many examples of this in the astronomy literature. What they do is they leave the clock drive running so the umbra is stationary, and then at stated intervals during the eclipse, they'll take a snapshot exposure of the moon. Of course, you need a camera where you can actually make multiple exposures on the same frame if you're still in chemo photography. In digital photography, you simply superimpose the separate images to make a montage. And you see then very clearly that the umbra is a larger circle, about twice or so the size of the moon herself. In slide 14, I take up a question which is asked of me from time to time. the moon's surface is not smooth and flat like a projection screen or a wall, but is very, very irregular, rough territory. You see there in this picture a regular gibbous moon. It's not anything to do with an eclipse, but just to bring out that the moon's surface is filled with deep valleys, deep craters, and tall mountains, steep slopes. And how the hell could a shadow of the Earth cast onto it be so uniform and smooth and regular? Wouldn't it be all chopped up and lumpy, and as a shadow came across, it would change shape as it goes over different parts of the moon's surface? Certainly a very, very fair question, but we'll answer that in our next slide, 15. A borrowed picture. The photographer was near the top at a visitor's overlook of this particular building on Manhattan, and among the pictures he took was the shadow of that building cast onto the ground. Now that ground is not flat. It's all the skyscrapers and streets below, with a relief, say from street to the tops of these skyscrapers, of 100 to 200 meters, with vertical lines and inclined surfaces and tilted angles and so on. Yet the shadow is surprisingly recognizable, the straight edges and the symmetrical left and right. What building is this? Come on, come on. What? Well, you're close. Empire State Building. Imperial State Building. That was a good guess, though. Empire State Building on Manhattan. If you go to the visitor's deck, it's an open balcony, like the balcony of an apartment house, and it's 300 meters off the street. In fact, you can actually put your head through the guard screens and see the street below you. Factoid for your physics friends. The scene you see down at the street from that elevation actually occurred 1 microsecond earlier. That's how long it takes the light from the street scene on the ground to reach you 300 meters away. But see, you can have a shadow cast onto a arbitrarily irregular, rough surface, even disconnected and disjointed surface, and tell what building it is by its surprisingly smooth and consistent shadow. What about a question there? The piggy bank joke? Yeah. It is a joke, but it could be disastrous if you try it out. When we were kids, and we went to the top of the Empire State, back then it was $5 to get to the top, which basically blew our allowance and car fare. And we dare each other to drop a penny off the top, on the idea that the person it hits would turn into a piggy bank. That is, the penny would cut a slit in the top of his head. Of course, we didn't physically do it, and if there were monitors walking around to keep things in order, so even if we tried, we'd be intercepted. But that's the piggy bank joke. Okay, move on to slide 16. Well, I tell you, the early astronomers kind of knew this stuff. Apart from understanding how lunar and solar eclipses occurred, they also knew, as one of the evidences, that the Earth is a sphere. Exactamentally, by measuring the size and shape of the Earth's shadow during a lunar eclipse. this fantastic drawing from a medieval astronomy text shows how the shape of the casting object is revealed by the shadow on the moon during an eclipse. The shadow is round, pointing to, on the left, a round or spherical Earth. Now, in an instant snapshot, you could say, well, no, the Earth could be a cylinder, which during this eclipse is seen edge on. Well, all eclipses show a circular shadow with the sun shining across the Earth on all angles. So the only geometrical shape whose shadow is a circle, no matter how that shape is oriented, is a sphere. And every educated person knew this. I mean, Columbus did not think the Earth was flat. I mean, he just had the wrong size of the Earth. He thought that the ships he had would last with provisions and durability and repairs and so on, could last the journey across the ocean. If he knew the correct size, then when he got to the end of his endurance, with more ocean to go, he would have been a goner. But no, he was just dumb luck that the distance he traveled landed him in a whole new continent, which interrupted the water path between Europe and China and Japan. So the Earth is spherical. I mean, he knew that, he just had the wrong size. But the lower two show if the Earth is a square or cube, you manifest that, or a triangular shape, it will manifest itself in the shadow during an eclipse. You might actually do this, turn on a slide projector just so the lamp shines on the wall, and take different building blocks or other small objects, hold it in the light beam, and you can see how as you turn the object, the shadow changes shape. In fact, you might have a screen or shade behind the projector so that the class cannot see what you're actually holding up. And you say, can you tell me what this object is? And you pick up, let's say, a scissor. And as you turn it around, the shape of the shadow changes, and the students have to guess that it's a scissor, or a notebook, or a thimble, or whatever. An eraser, a roll of scotch tape. So if you take it with a ball, a round sphere, no matter how you turn it, it always is a circular shadow. So that was the evidence that the early astronomers used to show that the Earth is in fact a sphere. Because they knew it's a sphere by the aspect of the sky, your latitudinal limits, as you went from one latitude to another, or one longitude to another, and they figured out that only a spherical surface would give you that reproduction of sky. And of course the astrolab is in fact based on that presumption of a spherical Earth. But that's a delightful little picture showing how 500 years ago we had that sussed out. Because the Greeks knew this already. And if you read the Almagest, which was the textbook that's preserved by from the Ptolemaeus, that he mentioned in there specifically, the Earth is a sphere. That's going back essentially 2,000 years. There are three main kinds of lunar eclipse, and these are illustrated in slide 17. The shadow of the Earth has a deep, dark center, that's the umbra, and then there's a shaded, thinner section beyond that, the penumbra. If the moon is a little too far from the node to get into the umbra, which is the left-hand picture, it could still be close enough to skim through the penumbra. Now, the penumbra receives direct sunlight, not filtered or refracted. So it is, in comparison to the umbra, rather bright, or let's say, so weakly dark that, for all practical purposes, we ignore, as home astronomers, penumbral eclipses. And you look at the full moon, there's no obvious change in brightness because the umbra, which is almost completely filled with sunlight, is passing over it. There's an exception, and we'll see that momentarily. But that is one type, which is generally neglected or passed over, and most astronomers don't even bother predicting them. The second one, the middle, the moon is close enough to the node to at least touch and get into the umbra part way. So there always is a segment of moon exposed. And that is a partial lunar eclipse. These are fun to watch, and they bring out the public, because they actually show that the moon physically moves. Now, the jargon varies among astronomers. If you fixate on the moon, which is, you know, the obvious bright thing in the sky, the shadow moves across the moon. If you think in terms of the orbital mechanics of the moon, the umbra is essentially stationary in the stars. The fractional degree it moves during the eclipse can be neglected, and the moon plows through it. So both references are valid. And I know in some of the literature, you read an article, the author hops from one to the other, and once in a while you forget what he's trying to say. But that is a partial eclipse. The right-hand one, which is the eclipse we're getting now, November 8th, is a total eclipse. The moon is so close to the node that it can actually fit completely into the umbra and be completely covered, making the eclipse total. And for the duration of passage through the umbra, the moon is a dull, dim, but perfectly obvious in most cases, red or orangey ball. We're getting the total eclipse this time, but I've seen a mix of totals and partials, and I never even bothered going out to watch a penumbral eclipse. There just was no interest to me. We get the sequence or stages of the eclipse in figure 18. And we actually start at the upper left and we proceed down to the lower right. Now they do show several stages, they're not all exactly the way I would like it, but no, it's close enough. The pre-eclipse moon, before it enters the penumbra, which is just a geometrical moment, nothing really happens then, and the moon is essentially completely unaltered until the umbra touches the moon, which is called first contact, or when the umbra is externally tangent to the moon. That's the second picture down, counting from the upper left, where the umbra is just touching the moon. And it creeps across, creeps across, creeps across, And finally we get to the second contact, or when the totality begins. The Umbra has just completely covered the moon, and now you have the total phase, which can last, you know, pretty long, about almost 2 hours at most, but usually, you know, a fat hour, an hour and a half is kind of the normal length, because the moon may not go centrally across the umbra, may go off on one side or the other, like we saw in the previous slide. And then third contact, by the way, the contact names are not given on here, but first contact is when the umbra first touches the moon and the partial phases begin. Second contact is when the umbra just completely covers, leaving no unexposed, uncovered, leaving no exposed bit of moon. Third contact is when the umbra starts to slide off and first exposes a bit of the raw full moon. That's third contact. Totality ends. The partial phase ends when the umbra completely leaves the moon with no residual darkening, and you have at the bottom the complete full moon once again. This sequence assumes that the moon is in your sky, in a dark sky, for the entire eclipse. The one in May 2022 was an eclipse like this, except that the weather, you know, kicked us out of the box. It's a very leisurely path through the umbra. We'll see that when we get to the particulars of our own eclipse. But it's very, very, about 4 hours or more end to end, first contact through fourth contact. And if the weather is mild and it does occur at a convenient hour, some clubs arrange public viewing, or a neighborhood group will have like a little block party, or a it's not a block party as such, but where the neighbors come out on the stoops or porches and they say hello to each other, and then maybe one of them with binoculars walks up and down the block and offers views of the eclipse. So we spoke generally about eclipses so far. Now in 19, we begin investigating our coming eclipse. This is the standard sequence or stage diagram, starting from the lower right and extending upward to the upper left. Very similar to the photograph sequence in the previous slide, this shows the entrance into the penumbra, which is a totally geometrical event. Nothing happens. Then you have second contact, when the moon touches the umbra, and you get this smidging dark blotch at one side of the moon. By the way, if you think of the astronomical coordinates, the moon moves west to east in her own orbit. So it will enter the umbra somewhere on the front, forward, east side of the disk. And after the eclipse, the umbra slides off at the trailing rear or west side of the disk. Okay? Now this is not the diurnal motion of the moon and the whole sky. It's the movement of the moon against those stars and through the essentially stationary, that is, against the stars, patch of the umbra. Okay, so entering the penumbra is just a clock event. Then you have partial phases begins, which is contact one. A few astronomers recall the initial entry into the penumbra, contact zero. And they may do that because the math program that they're using to make the calculations have to designate that event numerically, so they give it number zero. Okay, then the next step is where the moon has entered completely into the umbra, totality begins, and that is second contact. And you get the middle of the eclipse, halfway, when the moon is the farthest into the umbra, that is when the center of the moon is closest angularly to the center of the umbra, both being circles. A third contact is where the totality ends and the moon starts to peak out. Fourth contact, the partial phase ends, the umbra finally slides completely away. Then you have what some of us call fifth contact, when the moon leaves the penumbra. All the times in this picture are universal time, and if you convert these to your local zone time, depending where you are in the world that you're listening to this lesson, you may have to go back to standard time rather than summer or daylight time. For the United States, the eclipse occurs in the realm of standard time. We made the shift, or you will make that shift, on November 6th, the Sunday before. The eclipse occurs on Tuesday, which, again, I remind you, is election day. Now, the eclipse occurs all over the United States pretty much before the polling stations open. I believe in New York City, the polling stations will open at 6 in the morning, which is when the moon is pretty much in totality. And as you're going there, say, before you, then you head off, you do that before going to work or school, and you look and you see the red tint on the moon. Doesn't that have a political connotation for the results of the election? Red. Now what could that mean in American politics? But don't you worry, the other side once in a while wins elections, and once in a blue moon. In 20 and 21, I reproduced the NASA eclipse fact sheet for our coming lunar eclipse. Negative image, make it easier to read. For those of us who like to graphically lay out and map the eclipse for themselves, they may want to use a large sheet of paper, drawing tools, and they may even have a map of the moon with some craters on it so they can tell when to anticipate the umbra crossing or uncovering a particular crater. So all the numbers here. If you've done this before, or you're game to graphics and mechanical drawing kind of stuff, this is the data you need. It's upper half of that fact sheet. The cutoff picture at the bottom is nothing more than the one I showed in the previous slide 19. 21 is the lower half of that sheet. It shows the sequence diagram more completely and additional parameters for you to fool around with in doing your own layout of the eclipse. It's a lot of fun to do, and you learn a lot about the geometry of eclipses by going through this for one or two eclipses. The lunar eclipses are easier to do. Solar eclipses, you have to factor in your location on the ground, and on my own judges, unless you really are into the mathematics of astronomy, lay off at that. But the lunar eclipse ones are pretty easy to do. It takes patience, double checking all your arithmetic, use a calculator, and make sure you read properly the measurements on your ruler, fine tip pencil, all that rest. The eclipse is visible over a little more than half of the Earth. That is, because the eclipse takes several hours, the Earth will rotate a little bit during the eclipse. So it's not just the instantaneous half of the Earth where the moon is above the horizon, but the half and maybe an eighth more. So probably 5/8 of the world will see at least something of the eclipse. So slide 22 is a visibility chart. The dark areas see the eclipse, and the white area in the center, which is basically the Atlantic Ocean, misses it, and actually parts of Europe too. So the east coast of the U.S. sees the eclipse when the moon is about setting. That is, the white area represents the sunrise. The rest of the United States and all of Quebec and Canada and Mexico and most of South America do see the entire eclipse. And in the Eastern Hemisphere, Eastern Europe and all of Asia get the eclipse, and Africa kind of misses out. At the border where the light and the dark have meet, the eclipse is occurring on the left side. That is the left side of that cone area is the eclipse occurring near moon set. But because it's a full moon opposite the sun, it's also occurring near sunrise in a dawn and twilight sky. The right-hand side, you know, in Asia, Europe, the eclipse is occurring at moonrise or at dusk and twilight of local sunset. So that's the situation of the eclipse of the moon. So that's why most of us who are not astronomers will remember seeing a lunar eclipse. Very few casual people will remember seeing a total eclipse, and usually that's because it occurred close to their location, so the eclipse was a large partial eclipse, or if they're exceedingly fortunate, they were in the path of totality. This happened when a couple of occasions my sister, when she moved out of town, by absolute dumb luck, she moved to a place which was within the eclipse totality path of the 1970 solar eclipse. When my niece moved a few years ago to her new place, by dumb luck, she moved into the central path of the eclipse in 2017. And a lady buddy of mine, a lady friend, built a house upstate New York, which was by dumb luck in the central line of an annular eclipse. But apart from crazy situations like that, most ordinary folk will not remember seeing a solar eclipse, but they'll see a lunar eclipse simply because it's visible over a little more than half of the entire Earth. Okay, for New York City or the New York Sky area generally, slide 23 shows the skyscape looking toward the west-northwest into the moon, which is near the bottom because it has low altitude, about when totality begins, at second contact. I put in here several stars, the brightest stars for orientation's sake. You see, the moon is near the Hyades and Pleiades, which might make a very good photo opportunity. And you have Orion nearby to the left, and then farther to the left in the south area is Sirius. And you have the rest of the winter hexagon, as it's often called, Procyon, Castor Pollux, Capella, and then you come back to the Hyades for Aldebaran and Orion for Rigel. Through in Capella and Merfak for orientation, and in the north there's Polaris over on the right hand side, and toward the top right is the Big Dipper. So that gives you the scene. Now, if you're in the time zone to the west, Central Mountain Pacific, then this entire map would be rotated clockwise around Polaris. So the moon would be in higher sky, Orion would be more to the south, and you'd probably see Andromeda, Pegasus, and Aries more clearly over the horizon. Actually, Aries is down on the horizon, but I didn't label any stars there. Besides the eclipsed moon, above, or let's say farther east in the ecliptic, that's that vertical line, is Mars. And Mars is teasing you because it's saying, ha 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 ha, the moon is in eclipse, in November it's full moon, but the next full moon in December will eclipse me, or occult, or if you're in the wrong area, like I mentioned during the Mars session, you'll get a close miss or a very nice conjunction. So the conjunction is beautiful, the near miss more so, and the most spectacular is the occultation. So you can anticipate, and you can trace maybe if you want in your planetarium program, especially since it's a different time zone, the plotting of the moon maybe every 12 hours as it notches its way onto Mars. So that's the sky scene for the New York skies area surrounding New York City. A timetable of activity for the eclipse in New York is given in slide 24. I start at midnight and then go through moon set and sunrise. And we note that the moon sets while it's still in totality. Third contact occurs a minute or so after moon set. And we have that the totality is mostly in a dawn sky, nautical or civil dawn. And I give the altitude and azimuth of the moon, which will help you plan for a proper viewing location, especially for the latter stages, say since from dawn on, where it may be hard to see the moon against a bright sky. So you may want to make sure that the area where the moon is has no obstructions in front of it. So you may want to start scouting around now for a proper location. Elevation helps to get above low-lying landscape. A table like this would be very useful if you were to make one for your time zone and especially for your latitude. And of course the numbers would be totally, it'd be a totally different chart. Don't try to edit this one. I mentioned penumbra. Nothing really happens. Well, on occasion, but not always, this happens to be a penumbral eclipse, which where the moon never got to the umbra, and the right-hand picture shows the moon the farthest into the penumbra, and in the upper right, you see a little smokiness. That's the extreme inner edge of the penumbra where it would meet the umbra, which is off the moon to the upper right. What can happen is a scene like this about 15 minutes before first contact at the point where the umbra will come onto the moon, you may see a smokiness, haziness on that part of the moon, which is the extreme inner edge of the penumbra, which suffers so little direct sunlight that it can be a shadiness on the moon. But the rest of the moon, especially in the lower left part, is pretty much full moon brilliance. So keep an eye out for that, and it also helps so you recognize that's where the umbra will come on. Similarly, after fourth contact, there may be where the umbra left the moon a lingering smoky patch at that spot, and that certainly confirms to you, okay, now the eclipse is over, it's done. So keep your eye out for that. It doesn't always occur. I nominally, in the timetable, assume 15 minutes. Some people would give 20 minutes, although I don't think I ever saw a penumbra 20 minutes too early. 15 minutes, yes. 10 minutes, certainly. But that's only if, for some reason or other, the umbra has a dark inner edge. While the lunar eclipse is taking place as seen from the Earth, crank up your solar system program and stand on the moon. This is what we see in slide 25. The fellow on the moon at a particular location, such as a certain crater or mountain or a bay, Mara, he will see a solar eclipse. So as the shadow and penumbra and umbra move across the moon and pass him over his location, he will see the partial phases of a solar eclipse, a total phase, and then partial when the shadow moves away. Now, because the Earth is like 3.5 times the angular size of the moon, it would take a lot longer to cross over the sun. Now, typically an hour-ish duration, so totality will last a while. Here in that slide 25, we see the sun, the corona, peeping out behind the Earth, and the reddish illumination characteristic of totality on the ground. You may want to do this for yourself, pick a crater on the moon. It doesn't have to be for this lunar, for anyone, and actually see as the penumbra is moving over that area, the sun is being covered over, and when the umbra touches that point, totality on the moon begins, and then you can follow the rest of the eclipse then after. It's a lot of fun to do this, but you need a nice solar system program that lets you stand on other parts of the solar system. Now, in totality, the color, darkness, and texture of the umbra can vary widely from eclipse to eclipse. During a particular eclipse, it maintains a particular aspect, but when you compare it to other eclipses, you may get a great range of aspects. And this we see in slide 27. There's several umbrae in the total phase of various eclipses, and the kind of a typical eclipse is up there in the upper left, and in this particular instance the umbra was not uniformly dark all over, but apparently the middle part of it, which is in the upper left, was darker than the outer edges, which are more toward the lower right, but you have a nice reddish tint, as most eclipses tend to be. An extremely dark eclipse is given on the two right-hand pictures, upper right and lower right, where in some cases you actually need binoculars to find the moon in totality if you did not follow it continuously during the eclipse. And you took a break, and now you pick up, look up in the sky, or, hey, wait a minute, where's the moon? Where's the moon? Where's the moon? So then you put the binoculars and you look at the star chart. Okay, there's this star. There's the moon. Yeah, you know, it's a little smudge against the background sky. The lower left picture is an example of an extremely bright totality, where the moon had almost no red tint, but more of a yellowish tint. And yes, I and pretty much all of us elders here have seen eclipses of this entire range of umbra in the total phases. What will happen this time in November, we don't know. However, there is this big volcano in the South Pacific near the island of Tonga, which is blowing off dust all around the world. It could be on the edge of the Earth as viewed from the moon and may block sunlight from going into the umbra. If that happens, we will end up with a darker eclipse like one of the two on the right-hand side. On the other hand, the dust may be distributed such that it is not near the limb of the Earth or only in a few parts around the limb, so enough sunlight gets through to give you the upper left corner picture, a more typical reddish eclipse. 28 shows a very unusual event. I used to think it was an optical effect. The edge of the umbra as it's coming onto the moon sometimes will show a blue fringe. And I used to think that maybe a contrast effect between the dark umbra and the bright moon and the black sky around it or some such thing. I've seen the effect, but subsequently I learned that it is real because people photograph it, and of course with digital imaging like this picture here, it actually shows up. So it is a blue fringe which may or may not appear in your particular eclipse, certainly the one that's coming up now. This, I hazard, is due to refraction into the umbra of some of the blue rays of the sun shining into the atmosphere, which tend to collect near the edge of the umbra. That is, they're not refracted as much as the red rays. So look out for that, and if possible, get a picture, a photograph, or a digital image of that. It's a very curious effect. Okay, in slide 29, we see another very interesting effect. It's comparing the umbra in totality of two eclipses in 2003, one in May and one in November. The right-hand one looks kind of normal. I don't think there's a blue edge on this. This is kind of right. In fact, I would almost think that the umbra didn't quite cover the whole moon yet. But then you have normal, then you can see the Maria in totality in some of the brightest spots. In May, it's a darker eclipse, but at the top, the blue fringe. So, don't think that lunar eclipses are not interesting. They can be very pleasantly surprised at the optical effects that can occur. This slide, 29, embodies a quiz. So keep this slide in mind, okay? There are 40 slides in this lesson, so we're coming into the home stretch. So we look at slide 30, which begins several experiments or observations that you could try. The skill and equipment needed vary a lot, but some of them can be done with the bare eye or eyeball at the telescope, whereas others you need some pretty fancy stuff. But this is mostly for those who are seeing the eclipse in a dark sky, so probably none of these would be useful for us along the eastern coast in the New York skies area, because the eclipse in totality takes place in a dawn sky, and all of these do require a sky that's populated with stars down to the magnitude limit that the sky conditions would permit. Number one, we have globe at night. Now the normal globe at night period in November is November 16th through the 25th. Now it may be a day off in that, but in any case, it does not include November 8th. Many of us will throw in an extra observation in the totality of the eclipse. Normally, the globe at night has dates when the moon is dark. There's the last couple of days before new and maybe one day old moon. So it's like a 9-day or sometimes 10-day stretch each month. The rest of that period, the moon is way too large for reliable transparency measurements. During an eclipse, you could get an extra special reading when otherwise you normally couldn't because of the full moon. So keep that in mind. If you're doing globe at night, do a measurement during totality of the eclipse, in addition to the normal run later on in November. In fact, the New York skies area, we begin our globe at night in November because that's when Orion, our constellation, comes into the viewing hours of the night, before midnight. I know elsewhere in the year or elsewhere in the world, other constellations are cycled through season by season. We just stay with Orion and we run from November into April. By then Orion is getting low in twilight. So, but keep that in mind, an extra observation for the lunar eclipse. If the umbra is dark, that is you have a dark eclipse and the sky is filled with stars, slide 31 is another observation you should try. Solar activity is still running high. In fact, the last I noticed, the sunspot count is approaching what we anticipate the maximum in 2024 to be. So we may have either a very early peak or the peak in 2024 will be extra high. But in any case, we have the high activity. So sweep around the northern quadrant of the sky for possible northern lights. In a large moon, and certainly full moon, you simply would never see it. So with the darkness imposed by the totality, if an aurora is in progress over your location or somewhere to the north, then you may get a reading, a picture, a notes taken of a northern lights. A favorite exercise is crater timings, that is, timing when the umbra crosses and covers a certain crater and when it uncovers and leaves that crater. So in slide 32, I have a scene from some observer where he picked out particular craters on the moon, those which were recognizable during full moon phase. So maybe he went the night before or a couple of hours before the eclipse and made a list of which craters he wanted to try. And then as the umbra passed on to it, he wrote down the time, and when the umbra leaves the crater, he got another time, and you can build up a map like the one we see in this scene. The reason for doing this is sometimes it's alleged that the umbra is larger optically than what is geometrically calculated to be. So that approaches to a crater or a contact point is a little early, and the reproach or egress from a contact point is a little later. Now, I myself haven't really seen this effect for sure, but the one way of monitoring it is to get lots of timings from definite points all over the moon. So you pick the bright craters that show up well in the full moon phase, and well, you have your timing just to the nearest minute, that's the best you can do, from your computer clock or your cell phone clock. Well, that's tied to the global time services. If you be a variable star observer or a nova search observer, then try your hand at capturing measurements of stars which otherwise would be blotted out by full moon, or search your area during the totality, whereas normally you just pass up those nights. So slide 33 gives an example of a variable star observing chart. This happens to be for Nova Delphini several years ago, which we all had a lot of fun with. It was visible easily in binoculars from within New York. The little crosshair in the center is the location of the nova, and then stars surrounding it are labeled with their magnitude, you know, brightness ratings. This always to the tenth of a magnitude with the decimal point left out. The decimal point might look like a star, so the convention has been that as long as you know that the magnitudes are only to the tenth, then you mentally put the decimal in front of the last digit, and you box in the star between those comparison stars, and you note the date and the hour, and so on. So this can be done for stars which you know from your experience are getting kind of dim, but you would lose the record for them because the moon is too bright. So during totality, you can fill in that gap. Also, Nova Delphini, you may want to have, if you're in the program already, a look at your search area, which is a patch, I think it's 10 degrees on a side. That's why I remember it anyway. But it's a manageable field that you can walk over in binoculars in a few minutes. And the idea is to recognize a star that was not there the previous night or earlier that night, and monitor it, make sure that it's not an Earth satellite or an asteroid, and a normal variable star which simply got brighter, and make sure that, you know, that may be a new star. And observations can be best done in a dark sky. So number one, you see enough of the field stars in your area, and you may catch the nova at a dimmer brightness. So variable star and nova search are good exercises during totality. If you observe occultations of stars by the moon, you pretty much give up for large moon because you can't see the dimmer stars that will be occulted, and also it's very tiring on your eyes staring at the brilliant limb of the moon looking for the little star that's nudging up against it. During totality, stars which would be occulted, like those shown in this picture, slide 34, would be occulted by the moon, and you can get some timings which otherwise would be lost. Now, in all honesty, the home astronomer scientific contributions are pretty small. The observations are now made by automated telescopes. These are telescopes about the size of a garbage can, that is an outdoor, like an old ash can sized thing, or those orange plastic barrels that they put out, you know, to mark off road construction. And these are GPS located, and they're either synchronized by remote control, or they are pre-programmed with the position of the moon and the star and take the measurements electronically. And I know that there are several groups who do this, and they go along a highway, and every so often they pull out from the back of the van one of these drum things and take the cover off, and you have this Darth Vader looking contraption, and they go off into the bushes and set it down, and they may take a picture of the area so they can come back and get the thing, and they go on a kilometer or so further on and repeat the process. And then they hear, pull over. What are you doing? Oh, retirement occultations. License, registration. We saw you dumping garbage down the road. Oh, no. And then you have to go out, open the van, show the equipment and all this kind of stuff. And the guy thinks it was kind of a loony bin, too stupid to be a terrorist. And he lets you off with a warning, you know. See, so you go into hiding for a while, and after the occultation is good and over, you crawl back and pick up the instruments, and then you pull out the smart card or the diskette and look at the data. So we don't use eye at the telescope for scientific functions too much. It can be useful if the automated scopes are rained out and you're in the next county and you have a clear spot, you know, they will call on you. See, but not for the routine scientific use. But they're a lot of fun. They inculcate you to the movements of the moon, and they can be useful if the star is a binary star, because then what will happen is you'll see a two-step decrease in brightness from full brightness to an intermediate, then a split second later blinking out, because the moon covered one component and then the other. And this can be done even though you cannot resolve the star in your telescope. But consider occultation work during the eclipse. You have to plan for this ahead of time by using a occultation prediction software and, you know, going through, say, the 2 or 3 hours bracketing totality, and then pick from that list stars which are, you know, within your telescope range. 35 is a little esoterical and does require high-speed videography equipment on a permanently mounted observatory telescope. I mean, it could be your home observatory, but you can't be one that you haul out of your garden shed and plop it down on the ground. It has to be in an enclosure, solid mount and all that, and some high-speed videography equipment to catch possibly the flash of a meteor hitting the moon. Normally these observations are made during the crescent moon phase, maybe up to an early gibbous, the 8, possibly 9-day-old moon. I'm talking about evening. Beyond that, there's too little dark area left, and the bright moon next to it would swamp many videography setups. So during totality of a solar lunar eclipse, you could try your hand at that by taking a video picture, several runs of a couple of minutes each, full disk, and examine each frame, which should be synchronized to a time service, and see if there's any suspicious blips which could be attributed to the burst of a meteor, the explosion flash of a meteor on the moon. 36 is a chance for you to be famous. During totality, look for comets. Ah, usually comet observing, or comet hunting, is done in twilight hours on the chance that the comet will be near perihelion and angularly closer to the sun and plausibly brighter. But comets have burst into view in a dark sky, and this area of the hour on the clock or of the month is generally neglected during large moon. But during totality, in a kind of normal nighttime star-filled night, you might take a sweep along the ecliptic, although comets can come from any inclination whatsoever, but you have to do something. Sweep around the moon, maybe a spiral path around the moon, picking up every suspicious misty spot and making damn sure you rule it out as a unresolved deep sky object than you possibly could have found a comet. Now this is an exaggerated view. I hyped up that comet picture near the eclipsed moon. This was a long ago eclipse. I forget which one, but it's a borrowed picture which I enhanced. Okay. We spoke a lot about the shadow of the Earth as seen on the Moon, but you realize you don't have to wait for a lunar eclipse to see the Earth's shadow. I showed two examples here. Turn to slide 37. This is a scene right after sunset. The sun is behind me, so I'm looking over the ocean. That is, the photographer who gave me this picture is looking over the ocean, that is a clear level horizon with a little bit of haze or moisture in the sky. So instantly the sun goes below the horizon, the atmosphere to the east where the sun already set is in darkness, actually no, twilight, whereas the atmosphere above you has still lighted by the sun shining over your head. Then you could see typically a demarcation between your illuminated atmosphere and the subdued lighting of twilight way off to the east, and that is, in fact, the shadow of the Earth. When it first creeps off the horizon, it's a pretty definite edge. After it comes up, I think maybe in 10 minutes or so, the edge will rise higher in the sky, and you will then have a mixture over you of dark and light, and then the edge diffuses, and then all of your landscape is in twilight. But that is something to look for. You face away from the sun. You get the same effect at sunrise, the few minutes before the sun comes up in the east. You face west, and just before the sun is about to rise, you may see that edging. In fact, for our eclipse now, if you have a good view to the west, the northwest, which you have to because the eclipse occurs near sunrise, you may actually see the shadow of the Earth crossing the moon, with the moon just inside of it in totality. That'd be a great sight, but you don't need the eclipse to see this effect. 38 shows a method of seeing the Earth's shadow which was all the rage in the 1960s when the space age was young and everybody, including home astronomers, were out there watching the early Earth satellites. And at first it was puzzling what would happen. I don't know which way the satellite is going across in this picture. Let's say it's coming from the left and it's in full sight, because you remember, we would watch for satellites during twilight, dark twilight, when the first stars are coming out, because you have to be in shade to give you a darker background sky, while the satellite 700 kilometers up is in sunlight. So there's a satellite coming across from the left, and it suddenly disappears in open sky. It went into the shadow of the Earth at its altitude above the ground. Or if the satellite is coming from the right, then we don't see it, and suddenly it pops into view because it came out from the shadow and now is in open sky with the sun shining on it. So that was a really nice thing to look for in the early days of satellite watching. Sometimes we would get a vague suggestion that the satellite may not be visible when it geometrically comes over the horizon, but you have to wait until it gets out of the shadow and then it goes into the open sky. Or the other way around, it will disappear from view before it geometrically reaches the horizon. So those are two ways where, without a lunar eclipse, you can take advantage of the methods to see and know that the Earth has a shadow. Well, planet Jupiter is still in our sky, regardless of eclipse or not. Evening sky, bright and brilliant in the south and southwest. And if you remember our lesson on observing Jupiter, the moons of Jupiter can go into eclipse. So here we have Jupiter and the shadow behind, just the outline of it, because it's just empty space out there, just like for the shadow of the Earth. You don't know it's there until something goes into it. And we have the track of a satellite in the lower left, which is enter the shadow and then sometime later comes out. And you can convince yourself, especially with a larger scope, that the shadow is in fact black, because the atmosphere of Jupiter is kind of opaque and sunlight cannot diffuse through it and fill into the umbra. And there's effectively no penumbra, because at the distance of Jupiter from the sun has shrunk down to a small disk, something like 6 arc minutes or 5 arc minutes across, and in any small scope you simply would never notice any penumbral effect at all. So if you're not favored with a view to see the Earth's shadow at sunrise or sunset, and there are no bright artificial satellites in the next few days, take a look at the shadow of Jupiter. Slide 40, our last slide in this lesson, is a table of lunar eclipses in New York. I started at the beginning of the century and I run out to about 2040, and you get the distant and data about the eclipse. And there are a few on the far right column where the eclipse does occur near moonrise or moonset. And so that just flags you that, well, you can get it from the hour to the hour is always in Eastern Standard Time. This program does not recognize, well, I think I turned it off, daylight savings time. So eclipses that occur in the spring, summer, and early fall in the United States will be in daylight time, but all you good astronomers put that in the trash can. So you can plan for future one. And of course, you can simulate these in your planetarium program. So that takes care of the lunar eclipse of November 8th. And now we come to the quiz. Okay, flip back to slide 29. That's the one with the two example eclipses in 2003, showing a blue-tinted umbra in a May eclipse, and then a more or less normal umbra with a graduated darkness in November. The quiz is, if you study carefully the dates and compare them to the dates of our eclipse and one in May in 2022, the question is, what really useful rule or method of foretelling eclipses does this slide illustrate? And an answer to that will come if you read the Eclipse Facts article, which I mentioned in the title slide, and which I think I've mentioned in previous lessons about eclipses. I did not specifically mention it here because that's your quiz. What good rule of thumb, which is amazingly accurate, that this slide illustrates relative to the eclipses of 2022. So until next time, pray for clear skies, and also on November 8th.